Pyrrhus was the pugnacious king of Epirus, around what is today southern Albania. In his later life, he styled himself as a hero of the Hellenic world, a defender of everything Greek. And right at that moment, the Greeks who most needed defending were the beleaguered colonies in southern Italy, in the region of Megale Hellas. These city-states found themselves suddenly menaced by an emerging regional force, the rising city-state of Rome. Throughout the 4th century BCE, this bizarre republic had been expanding, upsetting the established power balance in central Italy and ultimately absorbing all of Latium and the region of Campania, and were now extending their territory southward into southern Italy. Carthage took notice of this and penned another somewhat more anxious treaty with the Romans, asking them to promise not to found any cities in Africa. But on the whole, they seem to have welcomed the rise of Rome as a potential ally against the hated Greeks. The Roman capital even had a district known as the Vicus Africus, or African Quarter, suggesting that a population of Carthaginian merchants already lived and traded in the city. For Carthage, Rome was not so much an unwelcome rival as a new source of customers. But for the Greek states of southern Italy, Rome was a voracious new predator. Soon, many of them began sending out letters of distress to Pyrrhus, and the king of Epirus couldn't resist the call of this heroic struggle for the glory of Greece. He gathered an armada and a large army complete with 20 war elephants, and in 280 BCE, he sailed to southern Italy in full force. Pyrrhus defeated the Romans at Heraclea that year, and then at Ausculum the following spring, both at tremendous cost. He now expected them to cut their losses and admit defeat. But, slightly to the bemusement of Pyrrhus, Rome simply refused to admit defeat. This was something that would soon become a Roman hallmark. Some have argued that Rome's very nature as a citizen democracy contributed to its immense doggedness in warfare. Its leaders were politicians, in a state of constant competition for the support of the voting public, and any who signed a damaging peace treaty were likely to be eviscerated in public as a coward or even a traitor. This meant that in wars with Rome's enemies, its senators would overwhelmingly vote to continue a war rather than admit defeat. According to Plutarch, who was fond of inventing dialogue for his historical characters, Pyrrhus made the following quip after his third victory with Rome. We are told that Pyrrhus said to one who was congratulating him on his victory, "If we are victorious in one more battle with the Romans, we shall be utterly ruined." For he had lost a great part of the forces with which he came, and all his friends and generals except a few. Moreover, he had no others whom he could summon from home, and he saw that his allies in Italy were becoming indifferent, while the army of the Romans, as if from a fountain gushing forth indoors, was easily and speedily filled up again. After this series of Pyrrhic victories, Pyrrhus soon realized that the conquest of Italy would elude him. He came within miles of Rome, but the tall Servian wall surrounding the city meant that his beleaguered force had no hope of taking it. Still, he couldn't bear to return home empty-handed. Instead, Pyrrhus headed to Sicily with the aim of helping its Greek colonies in their fight against the Carthaginians. The Carthaginian response to Pyrrhus couldn't have been more different. They offered to pay him off generously to leave them alone, but Pyrrhus refused. Still, Sicily too eventually defeated him. After finally being routed in southern Italy, he cut his losses and sailed for home, with little to show for years of war. Plutarch imagines Pyrrhus as he sails away, reflecting on the situation he has left behind. Pyrrhus looked back at the island and said to those about him, "My friends, what a wrestling ground for Carthaginians and Romans we are leaving behind us." That wrestling ground would be the arena for the next dramatic period of Mediterranean history. A conflict would soon unfold that would dwarf the Sicilian Wars for intensity and scale, would last for the next 130 years, would bring both powers to the brink of bankruptcy, and cost more than 1 million lives. This was the beginning of the Punic Wars. The word Punic comes from Latin and is a mutation of the Greek word Phoenike, or Phoenician. At this time, the Romans used it to describe the Phoenician superpower of Carthage, their rival across the sea. The historian Cassius Dio summarizes the situation as Rome and Carthage slid towards war. The Carthaginians, who had long been powerful, and the Romans, who were now growing more rapidly stronger, kept viewing each other with jealousy, and they were led into war partly by the desire of continually acquiring more, and partly also by fear. It was a chance incident that broke their truce and plunged them into war. This chance incident would take place at a city called Messina, standing on the northeastern tip of Sicily, at the narrowest crossing between the island and mainland Italy. Messina was of immense strategic importance. Whoever controlled Messina controlled the crossing, and both Carthage and Rome were anxious about the city's future. Sicily at this time had something of the Wild West about it, a lawless land where bandits and mercenaries roamed the countryside. One such band were a group of mostly southern Italians who called themselves the Mamertines, or the Sons of Mars. They had been allowed into the walled city of Messina as refugees, but had betrayed its citizens and captured the city for themselves. Since then, they had spent 20 years running Messina as a kind of pirate fortress, a base to raid nearby towns and attack shipping. The trouble began in 265 BCE, when Iero, the last Greek king of Syracuse, moved to finally bring these Mamertine pirates to justice. Facing execution for their crimes, the Mamertines played the only card left to them, trading on the strategic importance of their city. Hedging their bets, they sent out requests for help to both the big players in the region, Carthage and Rome. The Carthaginians came to their aid first, of course delighted to seize a town from the Greeks. This was just the latest move in the nearly 2 centuries-long chess game on Sicily, but to the Romans it was worrying. They began to fear that Carthage was plotting an invasion of the mainland, as Polybius recalls. The Romans, foreseeing this and viewing it as a necessity for themselves not to abandon Messina, and thus allow the Carthaginians, as it were, to build a bridge for crossing over to Italy, debated the matter for long. The Roman Senate was bitterly divided on what to do, with many expressing disgust at coming to the aid of these brigands. But eventually their fears won out. They voted to send a force to Messina to secure the crossing, led by a consul named Appius Claudius. The Romans crossed the straits stealthily, evading the Carthaginian navy, and when they arrived at Messina, the Italian Mamertine pirates ousted the Carthaginian general who had come to their aid, and welcomed their fellow Italians into the town in his place. The Roman commander Appius then rounded on Syracuse, and its king Iero surrendered. This was the end of the last independent Greek states of Megale Hellas, and the future of the Mediterranean would now be decided by either Carthage or Rome. Both sides marched to war. In this conflict, the First Punic War, the Carthaginians treated Rome as a real threat. They drew up a large army of Celts, Iberians, and others, and sent it to Sicily. Still, they maintained faith in their overall strategy, which had served them well in previous Sicilian wars. While the warships of Carthage commanded the waves, their trading empire would continue to fill their treasury with gold, and there would always be soldiers ready to fight for them. The Carthaginian navy benefited from 1,000 years of Phoenician shipbuilding and sailing, but their relatively unchallenged dominance of the sea had also made them complacent. Their primary weapons for fighting on the water were the heavy bronze rams fixed to the fronts of their ships. The Phoenician sailors would outmaneuver enemy ships with their superior sailing and crash these rams into their sides, striking them in the hulls below the waterline. The Romans knew they could not outmatch the Carthaginians at this difficult style of combat. They would need to bring the battles at sea into more familiar territory. To this end, they developed an ingenious new technology, a kind of boarding bridge that they called a corvus or crow. These were raised like a drawbridge at the front of the ship and could be dropped down onto the deck of an enemy vessel, where a metal spike on the underside drove into the boards, allowing the Roman legionaries to flood on board. It was a brutally basic, but surprisingly effective tactic. The Carthaginian navy was busy plundering at a place called Mylae on the northern coast of Sicily when they saw Roman sails on the horizon. Polybius recounts that the Carthaginians put to sea, apparently not considering the engagement worth even the trouble of ranging their ships in any order. When they saw the crows on the prows of the Roman vessels, they were perplexed, until they saw them in action. The Romans drew close and their trap closed. Roman soldiers poured onto the Carthaginian vessels and a slaughter began. The Carthaginians turned and fled with the loss of 50 ships. For Carthage, this was a disaster. A Roman invasion force now descended on the North African coast, and in response, Carthage sent out the entirety of its fleet to meet them on the open sea. Polybius records that more than 600 ships came together in the Battle of Cape Ecnomus, probably involving at least 120,000 sailors, soldiers, rowers, and marines. The enormous battlefield would have devolved into a chaos of clashing oars and rams, shouting men and the din of the corvus bridges thudding down into the decks. By the end of the day, the result was a decisive defeat for the Carthaginians. With their enemies scattered, the Romans successfully made the crossing into Africa, just as Agathocles once had. The Carthaginians had had enough and asked the Romans for a peace treaty to sign. But the Roman demands were so punishing that even in their desperate state, they could not accept the terms. They fought on, and the Roman expeditionary force was beaten on the battlefield, and on the war went. The First Punic War dragged on for 23 years, with most of the fighting taking place in and around Sicily. It finally ended with Carthaginian surrender in 241 BCE and the signing of the Treaty of Lutatius. It was one of the longest continuous wars ever to take place in the ancient world, exhausting the men and resources of both Carthage and Rome. But Rome, as the victor, at least gained something from the years of carnage. Under the terms of the treaty, Carthage handed over all its remaining territory in Sicily, along with several groups of small islands nearby, and possibly Corsica too. It was also to pay a staggering 82 tons of silver in reparations over the next 10 years. All of this meant that Carthage could no longer afford to pay its armies. In the same year that the treaty was signed, a large band of its former mercenaries, around 20,000 men or so, camped outside the city, refusing to budge until they got paid. When the Carthaginian Senate still delayed payment, they mutinied and began looting and burning the countryside. When this news reached some of the discontented and war-weary cities of Libya, they saw their chance to throw off Carthaginian rule entirely. Soon the empire was engulfed in a civil war that Polybius tells us went on for 3 years. Carthage had no store of provisions ready, and no expectation whatever of external assistance from friends or allies. They were indeed now thoroughly taught the difference between a foreign war carried on beyond the seas and a domestic insurrection. The man put in charge of restoring order in Carthage was a general named Hamilcar Barca. At enormous cost, he eventually crushed these rebels, but this internal conflict weakened the empire even further. At Carthage's moment of greatest weakness, Rome moved to capture Sardinia from them too, and the Carthaginians could do nothing to stop them. The new balance of power in the Mediterranean was clear. If they were to reclaim any of the authority they once had had, the next generation of Carthaginian military leaders would need to produce a general of such genius that he could turn around the fortunes of this floundering empire. A general who could conduct a campaign so daring that it is still studied in military academies to this day. That man bore a name that in Phoenician meant by the grace of Baal, a man touched by the gods. His name was Hannibal. Hannibal was the son of the general Hamilcar Barca. When the First Punic War ended, he was a boy of only 6 years old, and through much of his childhood, the fires of civil war burned all around him. Having lost the last of its profitable Mediterranean islands, Carthage's only economic hope was for its best general to expand its remaining colonies in Spain. Hamilcar soon departed for Spain and took his young son Hannibal with him to teach him the art of war and to ensure that he passed on his hatred of Rome. In Spain, Hamilcar succeeded in conquering numerous Celtic tribes and built a new city that became known as New Carthage, now the southern Spanish city of Cartagena. As a boy, Hannibal might have visited the temple of Melkart or Hercules in Gades, now Cadiz, with a golden olive tree at its center. He might have heard stories about Hercules too, and his legendary journey over the Alps, herding the cattle of Geryon the giant. Perhaps he would have even learned the history of the Greek Agathocles and his daring strike at his stronger enemy. And all the while, he must have dreamed of one day making his own mark on history. When his father died, it fell to Hannibal to lead the Carthaginian armies in Spain. He inherited 60,000 battle-hardened troops and a stable of 200 war elephants. By the age of 27, Hannibal controlled more than half of the Iberian Peninsula, the wealthiest and most powerful province of the empire. The Roman poet Silius Italicus, in his first century epic poem, Punica, gives one later description of his character. By nature he was eager for action and faithless to his plighted word, a past master in cunning, but a strayer from justice. Once armed, he had no respect for heaven. He was brave for evil and despised the glory of peace. And a thirst for human blood burned in his inmost heart. Beyond all this, his youthful vigor longed to blot out the shame of the last generation and to drown the Treaty of Peace in the Sicilian Sea. His and his father's success in Spain restored the lifeblood of Carthage, and silver once again flowed through the empire. Hannibal soon felt increasingly confident about testing both the Carthaginian Senate and his hated enemy of Rome. The location for the flashpoint that would spark the Second Punic War was the town of Saguntum, now Sagunto, just north of Valencia in southern Spain. Although Rome had allowed Carthage to exercise power south of the Ebro River, it had made clear that it would not tolerate a Carthaginian attack on Saguntum, but Hannibal was willing to call Rome's bluff. In 219 BCE, aged just 28, he led his army against Saguntum and put it under siege. We can imagine that, back in Carthage, news of Hannibal's actions was met with both excitement and dismay. One of his opponents, a man named Hanno, is supposed to have delivered a blistering speech against him in the Senate. "It is Carthage against which Hannibal is now bringing up his penthouses and towers," the Roman historian Livy has him rage. "It is the walls of Carthage he is battering with his rams. Saguntum's walls will fall upon our heads, and the war we have entered upon with the Saguntines we must carry on against the Romans." But Hannibal also had plenty of supporters, and even his strongest opponents knew that any move against him could ignite a civil war that would cost them the wealthy Spanish provinces on which their entire economy now rested. The Romans, too, were paralyzed by indecision. For the 8 months of the siege, they did nothing but complain. When Hannibal finally took Saguntum, they sent a delegation of ambassadors to Africa to demand that he be arrested and handed over for punishment. The clouds of war were once more gathering over the sea. The historian Appian describes this moment as the Carthaginians chose the only option available to them. "The chief of the embassy, pointing to the fold of his toga and smiling, said, 'Here, Carthaginians, I bring you peace or war. You may take whichever you choose.' The latter replied, 'You may give us whichever you like.' When the Romans offered war, they all cried out, 'We accept it.'" During the civil wars of his childhood, Hannibal had learned never to let your homeland become a battlefield. And so he decided to take his war to Rome. He withdrew to his capital of New Carthage for the winter to prepare and plan. With the Roman navy now in control of the seas, Hannibal would have to travel by land, a journey of about 1,500 kilometers. And at its end, a monumental problem loomed. The Italian peninsula was a natural fortress, walled off by the snowy bastion of the Alps. To cross into Italy, Hannibal would need a radical solution. And it's here that those stories he heard as a child may have come back to him. Stories of the hero Hercules herding his cattle directly over those peaks. The Romans believed that it was impossible to cross the Alps with an army, burdened by supplies, horses, oxen, and elephants. It would be madness even to attempt it. For that reason, it was the last thing they would ever have expected. When spring came, Hannibal set out. In the foothills of the Pyrenees, he faced vicious attacks from local clans. And it was only through the lavish distribution of gifts that the Gauls allowed him and his men to pass through France. At the wide River Rhône, one of France's largest rivers, his army crossed with difficulty, building rafts to ferry men, equipment, and elephants across. Hannibal followed the Rhône north and reached the Alps in October. Winter was closing in, and the passes were choked with ice and snow. The later Roman writer, Ammianus Marcellinus, writes one account of these treacherous Alpine roads. "In these Cottian Alps, there rises a lofty ridge, which scarcely anyone can cross without danger. for as one comes from Gaul, it falls off with sheer incline, terrible to look upon because of overhanging cliffs on either side. The spreading valleys made treacherous by ice sometimes swallow up the traveller. The march to the top of the pass took 9 grueling days, but the descent proved even more treacherous than the climb. On their way down, they found that a recent landslide had turned what was already a difficult road into an impassable precipice. Hannibal's solution to this problem has become one of the most famous episodes in the mythical retellings of his journey that emerged over the following centuries. The story goes that he ordered his men to gather large amounts of wood and build an enormous fire against the rock of the precipice. As the flames licked at the icy stone and the rock heated, the soldiers poured their rations of sour wine against the heated rock, causing its temperature to drop rapidly and cracks to appear. With iron tools, they worked away at these cracks until after 4 days of labor, steps could be cut into the rock. Whatever the truth of this episode, the purpose of telling this story was clear. Here was a new Hercules, it said, a man who has crossed the Alps with his war elephants, a man who achieves great labors wherever he goes, a man for whom the very rock of the mountain presents no obstacle. Descending into the foothills, the men must have felt the lowland warmth wash over their skin with a sense of relief, as Livy recounts. Lower down, one comes to valleys and sunny slopes and rivulets, and near them woods and places that begin to be fitter for man's habitation. There the beasts were turned out to graze, and the men, exhausted with toiling at the road, were allowed to rest. Hannibal and his men looked out over the lands of Italy below. They had caught the Romans completely by surprise. The speed of Hannibal's attack stunned the Romans, as Polybius writes. Scarcely had the last rumour about the taking of Saguntum by the Carthaginians ceased to attract attention, the news came that Hannibal had arrived in Italy with his army. To make matters worse, Hannibal was now recruiting allies from among the Gaulish clans in the Alpine foothills. In response, General Sempronius Longus led an army of more than 40,000 to intercept Hannibal's forces. In December 218 BCE, they met at the Battle of Trebia, where Hannibal's powerful and determined forces utterly smashed the Roman army, killing at least 20,000 soldiers. From there, Hannibal marched south and crossed the Apennine Mountains that run down the centre of Italy, and crushed another Roman army on the shore of Lake Trasimene, killing another 15,000 men and capturing 10,000 prisoners. After that, he seemed unstoppable. Smarting from their first 2 encounters on home soil, the Romans quickly opted to avoid meeting him in battle, trying instead to suffocate his army and cut off his supplies. They even resorted to a scorched earth campaign, burning their own countryside in a desperate attempt to starve Hannibal's troops. Hannibal kept pushing south in the hope that the conquered Greek cities of southern Italy would greet him as a Herculean liberator and rise up against Roman rule, but the journey was hard. All but the largest of his elephants died in the Italian winter, and while riding through the marshes of central Italy, Hannibal caught an infection that caused the loss of one of his eyes. When he seized a large supply depot at the southern town of Cannae, the Roman Senate realized that their strategy of suffocating him wouldn't work. They ordered an 86,000-strong army to be drawn up, the largest that had ever been raised in Roman history, and sent it to meet Hannibal at Cannae. Once again, Hannibal's tactical genius won the day. The defeat was so total that even elite members of Roman society were slaughtered on the battlefield. When news of this staggering defeat reached Rome, the city went into a panic. Its citizens began seeing evil omens and portents everywhere. One senator was dispatched to Delphi to consult the oracle, and as the Carthaginians had once done under threat from Agathocles, the Romans resorted to rituals of human sacrifice to appease their angry gods, as Livy describes. By the direction of the books of fate, some unusual sacrifices were offered, amongst others a Gaulish man and woman, and a Greek man and woman were buried alive in the cattle market, in a place walled in with stone, which even before this time had been defiled with human victims, a sacrifice wholly alien to the Roman spirit. After the Battle of Cannae, many of the old Greek cities of southern Italy joined Hannibal and rebelled against Rome. For the next decade, war raged all over the region. In 211 BCE, Hannibal even marched on Rome itself. But just as Pyrrhus had before him, he found the imposing Servian wall too great an obstacle. Rome now realized that the only way they could turn the tide of this war was to attack Carthage in return. They sent an army into Spain, led by a general named Publius Cornelius Scipio, who had been among the few survivors of the Battle of Cannae. He attacked Carthage remorselessly and met with great success. In 209 BCE, in a devastating blow, Scipio captured the capital of New Carthage. 3 years later, he defeated the last remaining Carthaginian army in Spain, essentially seizing the entire province and its abundant silver mines for Rome. Despite everything that Hannibal had achieved, the war was starting to turn in Rome's favor. In 205 BCE, with Hannibal still rampaging in Italy, the Romans gave Scipio command of the armies of Sicily and ordered him to set sail for Africa, bringing war to the gates of Carthage itself. After a year of preparation, Scipio set sail in 204 BCE. Hannibal was forced to hurry back to Carthage and defend the city, as the Roman poet Silius Italicus renders it. Now that all her limbs were severed, Carthage depended entirely upon one man for support, and only the great name of Hannibal, even in his absence, kept the edifice of her greatness from falling in utter ruin. He alone remained. Without delay, envoys sailed across the Salt Sea to recall him and carry a message from his country. He was warned that should he linger, he might find no city of Carthage standing. The limited number of ships available forced Hannibal to leave many of his new recruits and almost all of his horses behind in Italy. The final confrontation between Hannibal's forces and the Romans in Africa would come in October 202 BCE at a place called Zama. Hannibal met Publius Scipio for the first time on the eve of the battle and presented a dejected, weary face, as Polybius writes. Next day, both commanders advanced from their camps, attended by a few horsemen. Presently, they left these escorts and met in the intervening space by themselves, each accompanied by an interpreter. Hannibal was the first to speak. After the usual salutation, he said that he wished that the Romans had never coveted any possession outside Italy, nor the Carthaginians outside Libya. Hannibal's forces included 80 elephants from the stables of Carthage. But events were starting to turn against them. One of Carthage's most important allies, the Kingdom of Numidia, which for centuries had provided its crucial shock cavalry, switched sides. Hannibal now found himself facing his own famous Numidian cavalrymen on the field. On top of this, the Romans had developed new tactics to neutralize Carthage's great strength, the fearsome war elephants. As the elephants charged, the Roman lines opened up to swallow them, and then pelted them with javelins. The animals panicked, stampeding back through the Carthaginian lines. In the chaos, the Numidian cavalry swung into the rear of the Carthaginian ranks, and Hannibal's army was driven from the field. He narrowly escaped with his life, and after retreating to the city of Hadrumetum with no forces left to fight, he bitterly advised the Carthaginian Senate to sue for peace. Carthage was once again decisively defeated. After 17 long years of war, all of its overseas territories, in Spain and elsewhere, were stripped away. Carthage was ordered to pay about 375 tons of silver, nearly five times the amount they had paid after the First Punic War. And the treaty banned them from keeping any war elephants and restricted the size of their fleet to only 10 ships, barely enough to even protect them from pirates. The rest of the Carthaginian navy was burned in its port. The Carthaginians were also restricted from declaring war anywhere outside Africa, and only in Africa if they got the permission of Rome first. They were now entirely subservient to Rome. Hannibal lived as a wanted man for another 20 years after the Battle of Zama. He went into exile in the east, fleeing to Tyre, and then to the Seleucid Empire and Armenia. The Greek writer Pausanias suggests that he died after having cut his finger on his drawn sword and developed septicemia from the wound. Other more dramatic stories describe him taking poison when he finds his dwelling place surrounded by soldiers loyal to the Romans, come to capture him and take him back to Rome in chains. The Second Punic War was over, and a 50-year peace descended on the Mediterranean. During this time, despite its diminished situation, money still flowed into Carthage from across the seas. So much so that the Carthaginians offered to pay off the entirety of the reparations they owed to Rome just 10 years after the end of the war, when the treaty had given them 50 years to pay. Some of the largest and grandest building projects in the city were constructed during these decades after the Second Punic War. For the people of Carthage, it must have been a time of renewed hope, as wounds began to heal. But their situation had its downsides. Banned from declaring war without Roman permission, Carthage repeatedly found itself defenseless against ambitious rivals in North Africa, who coveted the wealthy lands they still held. One of these was the new Roman ally and treacherous king of Numidia, Massinissa, who had stabbed them in the back at the Battle of Zama. Under the protection of Rome, he repeatedly moved to snatch away large swathes of their land. Each time this happened, the Carthaginians appealed to the Romans to allow them to defend themselves, but Rome consistently ruled in the Numidians' favor. In this way, Carthage was like a stricken whale being eaten alive by sharks. In 152 BCE, half a century after the end of the Second Punic War, the Numidian king seized a particularly valuable tract of farmland, and the Carthaginians were outraged. After stalling for some time, Rome finally agreed to send a delegation to Carthage to mediate this dispute. One of these diplomats was an irascible Roman senator by the name of Cato the Elder. Cato at this time was 81 years old and had fought against the armies of Hannibal in Italy. As a result, he had fostered a lifelong hatred of the Carthaginians. Arriving in Carthage, Cato expected to find a barbarian backwater, impoverished by two consecutive defeats at the hands of Rome. But what he found horrified him. Carthage seemed to be doing better than ever. In Plutarch's biography of Cato, he describes the old senator's reaction. The city was by no means in a poor and lowly state, as the Romans supposed, but rather teeming with vigorous fighting men, overflowing with enormous wealth, filled with arms of every sort and with military supplies, and more than a little emboldened by all this. Returning to Rome, shaken by what he had seen, Cato now dedicated the final years of his life to a single cause. At every debate in the Roman Senate, he ended each statement, whether on the price of grain or the wars in Gaul, whether on the appointment of new consuls or the response to a flood in the south, with a single phrase: Et ceterum senseo Carthaginem esse delendam, or sometimes the snappier, Carthago delenda est. Furthermore, I believe Carthage must be destroyed. Many in the Roman Senate were starting to agree with him. A year after Cato's visit, Carthaginian patience reached breaking point. The Numidians had gone too far, seizing yet another piece of wealthy land. Carthage sent an army of 50,000 men to seize back some of what the Numidians had taken, but their now weakened forces were decisively defeated. Still, to the Romans, this attempt had been a breach of their treaty, and enough of a pretext to go to war one final time and destroy their old rival for good. In 149 BCE, a large Roman army landed in North Africa and prepared to march on the city of Carthage. The Carthaginians were distraught. They sent envoys to meet the Romans, who demanded that the city be demilitarized. The Carthaginians complied and came back with every piece of armor and weaponry they could find, offering their total surrender. In response, the Romans offered them peace, on one condition. But it was a condition so absurd that they must have known it would be rejected. They demanded that the Carthaginians abandon their city so that it could be razed and moved 16 kilometers or so inland and away from the sea. For the seagoing Phoenicians of Carthage, complying with such a demand would have essentially ended their livelihoods for good. The Carthaginians withdrew to their city, which was still a formidable fortress. Its triple line of defensive walls could withstand any assault, and it had complex cistern systems for gathering and storing rainwater. The Romans, too, settled in for a siege, but found it tougher going than they had expected. They controlled the seas, but swift Carthaginian sailors were still able to smuggle food into the harbour at night. The Romans tried again and again to storm the city, but each time they were fought back by the citizens, now fighting for their survival with every tool and improvised weapon they could find, as Appian recounts. All the sacred places, the temples and every other unoccupied space, were turned into workshops, where men and women worked together day and night without pause, taking their food by turns on a fixed schedule. Each day they made 100 shields, 300 swords, 1,000 missiles for catapults, 500 darts and javelins, and as many catapults as they could. For string to bend them, the women cut off their hair for want of other fibers. The siege of Carthage went on for 3 years. In the year 147 BCE, command of the besieging army was given to a new consul, Scipio Aemilianus, who was the 36-year-old adopted grandson of Publius Scipio, who had beaten Hannibal at the Battle of Zama some 50 years earlier. With Aemilianus came his friend and official documenter of the expedition, the historian Polybius, who writes this part of his history as an eyewitness. As the siege dragged on, the Romans eventually built a stone barrier in the mouth of the harbour, blocking any further attempts to resupply the city. Food became scarce. Still, the defenders struggled on. But by spring 146 BCE, they were exhausted. Scipio Aemilianus finally breached the walls, and the legions poured in and began to massacre everyone they could find. The slaughter went on for 6 days, during which it's thought that 60,000 people were put to the sword. Scipio set his soldiers to work in shifts so that they would not become tired of the killing. And on the 7th day, he gave orders to begin taking prisoners. A further 50,000 Carthaginians were rounded up and sold into slavery. Carthage was burned to the ground and demolished brick by brick. Polybius, who accompanied Scipio throughout the entire siege, writes down that in the moment of his victory, Scipio is said to have wept and recited lines from Homer's Iliad. Scipio, beholding this city, which had flourished 700 years from its foundation and had ruled over so many lands, islands, and seas, now come to its end in total destruction. Scipio, beholding this spectacle, is said to have shed tears and publicly lamented the fortune of the enemy. After meditating by himself a long time and reflecting on the rise and fall of cities, nations, and empires, as well as of individuals, upon the fate of Troy, that once proud city, upon that of the Assyrians, the Medes, and the Persians, either voluntarily or otherwise, the words of the poet escaped his lips. The day shall come in which our sacred Troy and Priam, and the people over whom spear-bearing Priam rules, shall perish all. From its final victory in the Punic Wars, Rome emerged as the only superpower left in the Mediterranean. One by one, the scattered Greek kingdoms that remained were absorbed by the Roman Empire, and in the coming centuries, it would grow to encompass the entire shore of that sea and would shape the entire course of European history. Carthage, by contrast, would become just a name, a coin that had lost its value, an emblem of an age that had passed into nothing. After the sacking of the city, the Romans ensured that the blackened ruins were emptied of all life, that no locals crept back to repopulate its ruins, and that never again would their great rival resurface in North Africa. Some of the libraries and archives of Carthage, in which were kept their books of history and science, perhaps poetry and mythology, and records of the Phoenician voyages of discovery to the edges of the world, survived the burning of the city, and these were all taken by the Romans. Some were burned, while others were distributed among the Romans' African allies. As a result, virtually none have survived to the present day. Today, scarcely a few documents written by a Carthaginian can be read, and no works of literature or history. Their voices, just like their city, were erased, and for 2,000 years, their story has been told by others. The territory of Carthage was absorbed into the new Roman province of Africa, with the city of Utica as its capital. For the next century, what remained of the ruins of Carthage were left to crumble into the sands, overgrown with scrub and weeds, washed with salt carried on the sea air, a home for wild dogs, gulls, and crows. After a century of the city lying in ruins, Rome sent a party of 3,000 colonists to found a colony on the rubble. As they settled the area, the Punic ruins of Carthage were buried beneath a new Roman town that shared almost nothing of the city that had once stood there, except its name. And even the ruins of the city as they had once been were soon forgotten. Around 1835, the British statesman Sir Grenville Temple visited the ruins of Carthage and recorded his disappointment upon finding how little remained, now just a scatter of lonely, melancholy ruins. Early on the morning following, I walked to the site of the great Carthage, of that town at the sound of whose name mighty Rome herself had so often trembled. Of Carthage, the mistress of powerful and brave armies, of numerous fleets, and of the world's commerce, and to whom Africa, Spain, Sardinia, Corsica, Sicily, and Italy herself bowed in submission as to their sovereign. I was prepared to see but few vestiges of its former grandeur. It had so often suffered from the devastating effects of war that I knew many could not exist. But my heart sunk within me when ascending one of its hills, for I beheld nothing more than a few scattered and shapeless masses of masonry. Its very name is now unknown to the present inhabitants. The scene that once was animated by the presence of nearly a million of warlike inhabitants is now buried in the silence of the grave. No living soul appearing, except occasionally a soldier going or returning from the fort, or the solitary and motionless figure of an Arab, watching his flocks from the summit of the fragment of some former palace or temple. Solitude and silence hold sway over the whole scene, a scene which impresses on the mind a feeling of melancholy, which I found difficult to shake off.